John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today, and thank you so much for listening. This hour, we're going to look back at 2014 and the movement to legalize marijuana. We're going to talk about how far that movement has come, the pushback it's gotten along the way, and where it all goes in 2015. Plus, as legal marijuana spreads, edibles are also on the rise. And if you're going to eat it, why not eat well, right? People are cooking with cannabis. And we'll end the hour with a look at the best and worst unspiked food trends of 2014 with Dan Pashman of the Sporkful Podcast. But we begin this hour with a critical look at the relationship between the public, its politicians, and the U.S. military. At the end of World War II, nearly 10% of the U.S. population was on active military duty. Nearly every American knew someone in war. It was part of our daily lives, our culture, our daily conversations with one another. Well, today, fewer than 1% of Americans are on active duty, and despite 13 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, this is usually the closest any of us ever come to thinking about the realities.
I want to tell all the troops over there in Afghanistan how much we appreciate what they're doing for our country to protect our freedom. We are praying for you, and Omaha.
That's Denver Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning before the 2014 Super Bowl. In sports stadiums, in political debates, and just about everywhere else, support the troops has become so common a slogan that our next guest says it's passed into damaging cliche. James Fallows has spent a lot of time thinking about this shift in our relationship with the military and how, slogans notwithstanding, we've fundamentally degraded the way we think about this institution we hold in such high regard. James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He's written a comprehensive essay entitled The Tragedy of the American Military. James, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Todd, thanks very much.
It's very good to have you. You write in your piece about the chicken hawk nation as sort of the basis for a critique on the American culture's relationship with its military. What does that mean? What's the chicken hawk nation?
So the term chicken hawk is one that came into vogue, I guess, in the early Iraq war days, when you had people who themselves had not been part of the military but were eager for somebody else to go to war. That is the idea that you're happy to have a war as long as somebody else is going to do the fighting. In a way, I think that's come to exemplify the modern United States, where the vast majority of the country is not affected in any tangible way by the fact that we're perpetually at war. So we have fewer than 1% of the population who over the last dozen years have been more or less indefinitely extended in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And I think this is unwholesome for the country, for the military, for the world, and for our politics.
Now, you say it makes it not only too easy to go to war because of this separation between American society and its fighting forces, but also a disincentive for accountability, that Americans just don't demand the kind of accountability from the military brass that they used to, and that sort of adulation, and if I dare say it, fetishism for the military has taken the place of real accountability.
One thing I should tell your listeners before talking about accountability is that when saying it's too easy to go to war, it doesn't matter that I personally think that. I think it matters more that Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that on the record to him. He thought the separation between the military and the public had made it simply too easy to go to war. And Admiral Mullen, that man in charge of waging our wars for quite a long time, said he thought that in the future he hoped more people would have to be inconvenienced if the United States decided that it wanted to go to war. On the accountability front, I think many of your listeners, probably most modern Americans, have grown up in the age where there was nothing like a draft. There was no sort of enforced connection between military commitments around the world and the way most people went through their daily lives. And so there's been a sort of increasing distance, which is very different from the way American society worked through most of the 20th century. I talk in the piece about how after World War II, which is, of course, a mass mobilization war, and then even through the Korean and Vietnam ages, people may have been critical of the military, but they were familiar enough of it to respect what was good about it, but also recognize that, like any other large institution, it had shortcomings and failings and blind spots, and you could make fun of it. Now the idea of making fun of the military or referring to its members as anything other than heroes has become almost anathema. And you have what seems to me the really unwholesome pathology of these salute to the heroes rituals, which we have at halftime of games or when you get on airplanes early, substituting for any serious accountability of how the troops are being led, how our money is being spent, where people are going to be asked to fight and kill and die.
I've always wondered, James Fallows, if part of it isn't a collectivization of guilt from Vietnam as well. I mean, you talk about the accountability that came after Vietnam, which was both constructive, which was the military officer corps doing real reforms and real accountability on itself after the failures of Vietnam, but also a bad kind of accountability, which was the American public in many ways turning on the troops who were returning home, spitting on them. We've all heard of the images abusing soldiers who went to fight there after they came home. I wonder now if the reverence that is paid constantly at sporting events and everywhere else to the military without any real demand for the kind of accountability that you're talking about might come from sort of a collective guilt of the failures of Vietnam.
I think that is so. And I think there is a retrospective lesson that while within the military, as you point out, there was quite rigorous and excoriating examination of what had gone wrong with the officer corps and with tactics and with strategy and with ethics that led to all the agonies of Vietnam. I think as time goes on, the lesson from the public is that the public itself was wrong, in turning on so many of the actual fighting soldiers and fighting Marines and naval personnel who had been out there doing the nation's work. And so as time goes on, that's at least one mistake people aren't going to make. And it may have been, I haven't yet traced exactly the time when it became unvarying that you would refer to anybody in uniform as a hero. But sometime after a 9/11, that became the style, and it's almost dangerous not to do that now. People within the military know that theirs is a varied institution, as it has always been, with good people and bad people and the need for some kind of honest assessment. It does happen inside the military, but on the public basis. After our previous wars, you had presidents removing generals and commanders for reasons of military incompetence. Probably the most famous case would be Abraham Lincoln and George McClellan, but Harry Truman had his fights with Douglas MacArthur and all the rest. Now, when senior officers are relieved of command, it's almost always for discipline problems of some sort. General David Petraeus with his affair, Stanley McChrystal with his leaks, et cetera, and it's as if we think we can't judge them anymore on how they are doing their job as leaders.
Now, let's talk about our politicians for a moment, because they are the ones who hold the purse strings and set the policy. And you outline some major failures in that regard in your piece. It is extremely easy, in fact, common for members of Congress, among whom I spend much of my time, to lobby for increased military budgets. Even those who want to rein in the military in general only try to slow the growth, not cut the military. That's anathema. And fall over themselves to praise veterans all the time. And you think there's a major disconnect here?
There is. If you have the military not affecting most people in terms of only a tiny fraction of a congressperson's constituency will actually be in the service, the main way in which the military affects each district is through spending. And so you have people in the House and the Senate sort of falling over themselves to get projects for and subcontracts to their own district, even if they think that the projects are misinformed. There are two illustrations I mentioned in my piece. One is Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont. He thinks the F-35 fighter plane is a bad choice for America, but he's been pushing hard to get it based in Burlington, Vermont, because if it's going to be someplace, it might as well be Burlington and keep up the high-tech jobs there. The other is a vote in the House committee that was deciding on defense budgets. This was this fall, when the vote in the committee was 61-0 in favor of the military budget. This is the same House that can't agree on anything. But when it comes to military spending, there's basically there's no involvement in the details except for where the budget money goes district by district.
And it seems like there's not really much of a debate at all in Congress about the overall role of the military and the military budget. Now, we did have a debate over the last couple of years about the broad strokes of the American economy and federal budgeting. Military spending was part of that, and sequestration was one of the results. They didn't agree to much. But in the halls of Congress, there really isn't much debate about the size of the military, the amount of spending devoted to GDP. It's really one party that wants to increase things really, really drastically and another party that wants to increase them more slowly, in my estimation.
I would agree with that. And here are two ways to illustrate the difference. One is, when I was first reporting on these issues in the early 1980s, there were at least three prominent, rising, ambitious politicians who made their mark by talking about the details of military strategy and the big picture on how the U.S. should be involved. One was Gary Hart, who was, of course, then a young Democratic senator from Colorado, and two other were young Republican congressmen. They were Newt Gingrich and Dick Cheney. And the three of them actually agreed on more than they disagreed about the need to shift military strategy and weapons design and all that. It is almost impossible to find anybody like them in the Congress now, people who are really, really deeply informed and not in a partisan way on the way the United States should evolve its military strategy. Another illustration would be the 2012 debates between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, where the only time that military issues came up in the debates was simply a contest of who was going to spend more. Essentially, at the presidential level and the congressional level alike, the part of our political system that is designed to make big choices and to exert accountability just has atrophied away.
Well, you know, James Fallows, I'm a little worried, both for you and maybe a little bit for me, that some of the people who hear this discussion might simply respond by yelling at their radios, support the troops. You don't support the troops. And that makes me wonder where we go from here.
I will say that I've gotten a ton of response in the 24 hours since it's been out online. I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of letters, most of them from people either in the military or in military families. And most of those, an overwhelming majority, supportive, saying that they are the first ones to recognize the hollowness of saying, oh, yes, support the troops, now leave us alone. One young Marine wrote to me this morning saying, whenever he hears support the troops, what he hears, the way it sounds to him, is get back to your foxhole. So I think the empty slogans about support your troops, they are no real substitute for engaging with our troops and knowing our military and taking the same kind of critical responsibility for it that we do with any other institution that matters in our republic.
Perhaps fewer bumper stickers, perhaps fewer slogans, and maybe more actual sit-downs, more engagement with members of our military. James Fallows of The Atlantic, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Todd.
You can hear an extended version of my conversation with James Fallows on our website at thetakeaway.org. Meanwhile, we want your take. Do you think Americans have become too far removed from the realities of war? Has thanking the troops replaced serious accountability, as James Fallows says? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Coming up, we're going to look back at a year of victories and setbacks for the movement to legalize marijuana, and later, the best and worst food trends of 2014.
I think that this was the year that people started to really ask themselves serious life questions like, do I really need pumpkin spice cream cheese?
Dan Pashman on his favorite foods of the year and his food resolutions for 2015. They might horrify you. That's all coming up. Stay with us.
When it comes to the legalization of marijuana, Attorney General Eric Holder says he's, quote, cautiously optimistic.
I'm no pothead, but I certainly don't see a lot of high people walking around causing a lot of harm.
People who retail weed the old-fashioned way, like myself, I saw my business falling.
So if you believe the hype, we're all going to look back and say, see, this is when it all started, when pot got an image makeover.
Well, today we're looking back at efforts in 2014 to legalize and decriminalize, in some cases, marijuana. Voters in Oregon and Alaska approved a bill allowing for recreational marijuana. In other places like Philadelphia, they opted for decriminalization. The District of Columbia has decriminalization and then went for legalization until Congress stepped in and blocked it, probably. Meanwhile, medical marijuana was legalized in New York, in Minnesota, and even in Guam. We're here to talk about all of that and where this movement might be headed in 2015 is Gabriel Saya. He's Managing Director of Policy and Campaigns at the Drug Policy Alliance. here in New York. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's be clear. You're pretty firmly on the pro-legalization side, right?
Yeah. We work to end the prohibition of marijuana and end the war on drugs across the country.
Okay. We want to lay that out so that people know where you're coming from on this. Let's start in 2014. Washington state law was passed last year, but it finally went into effect in January, and their very first legal marijuana stores opened in Seattle and other stores across the state in Washington. What's their experience been like so far?
Well, it's in some ways, it's fascinating. You have a product that was being purchased on the illicit market now being sold in stores. It's now regulated. The product is being tested. Consumers know what they're getting. That's all a major change. But in other ways, it's surprisingly normal. I was in Denver, the other state that had a legalization bill on the ballot in 2012. I went to a store just to view it. I'd never been in one. And it was surprisingly boring in some ways. I mean, this was a store in a residential neighborhood. There was cafes and restaurants around, customers coming in and out. The store clerks were helpful in explaining everything that was going on. So yeah, some of this is really surprising, but a lot of this is really basic. And I think we're going to see an increased sweep of this kind of reform happening across the country.
There were ballot measures in Oregon and Alaska. Some people were surprised by Alaska. Overall, a conservative state. Was this a libertarian streak in Alaska?
Yeah, there is a libertarian streak. And Alaska's had a number of fairly more open marijuana policies on the books for many years. But it's the first red state to legalize marijuana. Oregon, of course, was more of a blue state. But what we see across the country with the polls and also with the electorate, this is an issue that both people on the left and the right support. It's not really a partisan issue in that regard. You see in the polls consistently that people on all sides of the political spectrum are saying, hey, these prohibition policies that we have, they got to change. This isn't working. We need to take a different approach. The one thing I'd add here, too, is that these are not pro-pot votes. Keep in mind, most of the people voting for these are not people who use marijuana. There's just a small number of Americans who use it regularly. While 100 million Americans have tried it, most people don't use it regularly. So most of these votes are not pro-pot votes by any stretch of the imagination. They're votes saying what we're doing on these policies doesn't work. We need to take a different approach here.
Now, in a lot of other places, I'm not sure that the assessment that it's not partisan necessarily holds. I live in the District of Columbia where voters, it's largely liberal city, the people who live in the district, had a ballot initiative that voted 70% to legalize marijuana. Now, Congress constitutionally has the ultimate final say, and Republicans in Congress largely turned around in a bigger spending bill and pretty much eviscerated that local marijuana law. Now, there's some legal loopholes and quirks about whether or not that will go forward, but Congress basically turned around and said, Republicans essentially said, no, sorry, District of Columbia, you can't legalize it. That was partisan.
Absolutely. And you see that kind of partisan activism, for some lack of a better term, around these practices happening across the country. I mean, look, here in New York, we just passed a medical marijuana law, and our Democratic governor, while he signed the provision, he worked really hard to narrow it and tried to defeat it before it was finally passed. But you, on the other hand, you do see Republicans like Dana Rohrabacher out of California, who sponsored the bills telling Department of Justice, hey, stay out of the state's way. If they're passing these marijuana laws, whether it's decriminalization, medical marijuana, or legalization, let the states move forward without interference. So it is something you see both Democrats and Republicans both supporting and in some cases opposing.
Well, Gabriel Slaya, no state is an island, I guess with the exception of Hawaii, of course. And there are cases now where other states who don't have legalization are complaining and suing states that do, saying these drugs are coming over the border. I want you to listen to Police Chief B.J. Wilkinson of Sidney, Nebraska. He was on the show back in July. Nebraska is one state that's suing Colorado because of drugs coming over to the border. Listen to the chief here.
There are people that leave Nebraska, go across the border, to take a 15-minute drive. They could go and purchase marijuana and marijuana-related products. And there's some sense of entitlement that, hey, guess what? I bought it legally. I possessed it legally. I should be able to bring it home legally. And Nebraska law doesn't say that. Nebraska law says it is illegal to possess any amount.
Now, that's one small town police chief near the Colorado border in Sidney, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. But this has gotten much bigger because his state of Nebraska and Oklahoma are now filing suit against Colorado, saying that their laws are causing an influx of drugs into their states.
Yeah, this is really a cheap shot in a lot of ways. You know, marijuana is a widely used, the most widely used illicit substance in the country. People in Nebraska and Oklahoma are using marijuana right now, and it's illegal. This lawsuit is hopefully not going to get picked up by the Supreme Court. It's frivolous in a lot of ways. The Supreme Court, when it has ruled on issues related to largely medical marijuana laws, it's allowed these things to move forward. The administration, the Obama administration, has recently laid out a series of conditions they say states need to follow if they're going to move forward in this direction to experiment. So hopefully the Supreme Court's not going to take this up. And we think that there's going to be an actual response to this by both folks in Colorado or in Oklahoma and in Nebraska, saying both on the right and the left, hey, this is a frivolous lawsuit. We shouldn't be taking this forward, and the Supreme Court shouldn't hear this.
But doesn't this potentially cut to the heart, the legal heart of legalization in a lot of ways, which is interstate commerce? Now, Colorado says it's legal within our mm-hmm. state. It's not legal to take it to Nebraska, but Nebraska could turn around and say, regardless of what you're telling your people, this is causing an increase in what we consider crime, and we want redress.
Sure, but think about this. Same thing happened with alcohol prohibition. I mean, look, where Jack Daniels is distilled, the county where it's distilled is a dry county, and you go a few counties over and you can actually buy it and drink it in bars. We have experience with these kinds of patchwork policy frameworks, but what we know is that ultimately the federal government's going to have to end prohibition, and until that happens, we're going to be operating in this environment that sometimes is gray, and states are going to move forward and do these reforms, but until the end of federal marijuana prohibition, we're going to have these types of legal challenges and questions about one state and another proceeding.
And in the meantime, in 2015, surely other states with ballot initiatives and potentially legislative initiatives. As we head into the 2016 general election, will marijuana be, in a way, on the national ballot in a national referendum? Gabriel Saya is managing director of policy and campaigns at the Drug Policy Alliance. Gabriel, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
States across the country reconsider their marijuana policies. What was once the stuff of just college dorm kitchens might soon be the latest gourmet trend. Marijuana-laced food has become all the rage in states and municipalities that have legalized the drug, and a number of publishers do have cookbooks in the works, and even leading chefs are starting to capitalize on the marijuana trend. Kim Severson is a correspondent covering food for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Well, in states where it's legal, of course, places like Colorado, maybe in Boulder or Seattle in Washington, what's already trending on the edible food front?
Well, the fact that people are cooking with weed is not a new trend, but what is new is the way it's moving into higher levels of cuisine, where you might see people actually thinking about how it tastes, thinking about how it might actually work with the culture of the table in the way wine or, you know, a martini might. And as things are getting legalized in the edible business is quite lucrative and quite organized at this point. I talked to a fellow who worked for the kitchen of a really great restaurant, and it's got two outlets in Denver and Boulder, who was losing line chefs to edible food companies. So there is a certain culinary appeal to marijuana that it hasn't enjoyed before.
Marijuana THC is fat soluble. Traditionally, people eat it in brownies. That might be passé at this point. Is it mostly in desserts where it's showing up on real tables or elsewhere in the meal?
Well, it's certainly showing up in desserts because it's easier to process it. You do have to cook marijuana, cook cannabis in some kind of an oil to pull out the things that actually make you feel differently. You can distribute that dose more evenly in something that's a batter or chocolate than you can, say, in a sauce you might put on fish. Also, there's a bit of a debate about what it tastes like. A lot of times, because they're using stems and shake from some of the marijuana plant to steep in this oil, it gets a bitter taste. And so it's a job of masking rather than enhancing. But chefs who really do have a forward palate are thinking about taking buds of marijuana that might have different savory characteristics in the way herbs like thyme or rosemary have, and trying to work it into dishes so that it sort of enhances the dish. In fact, there are some farmers who work with Noma Restaurant in Denmark who are growing a very low-grade THC. It doesn't get you very high, apparently, but using it to work into dishes so that marijuana is becoming something of a flavor component in some dishes.
Taste is essential, but so is the intoxication leveling. I guess probably you don't want to hit people over the head unless they know it's coming. I know you know I was going to go here, but there is a famous columnist from your paper, Maureen Dowd, who wrote about her experience in Colorado just eating way too much in an edible and just getting so intoxicated that she was holed up in her hotel room. So how are chefs kind of addressing that issue?
Well, I think they're refusing Maureen Dowd reservations. No, I'm kidding that. But, you know, I think that dosing is a very serious issue for people who cook with cannabis, and the people that I've interviewed are very somber about it and take it very seriously. The trick, I think, is to get it tested by a laboratory to make sure you really know or know your product so much that you understand what is going into each bite of the food that you're making. You know, again, it's a little like alcohol. So one might need to know what, say, two glasses of wine might do to you or a martini might do to you in terms of how it feels. So we're in this place where we're starting to try to quantify and be assured that when something says it has 10 milligrams of marijuana in it or THC in it, in fact, does, and that you, in fact, know how much that drug affects your body. But it's a lot of people likened it to prohibition. So now they're trying to, you know, to get the gin out of the bathtub and into some more manageable forms and move it into a larger culture.
There are craft cocktail makers all over America who have been taking cocktails to the next level for many, many years. And now chefs are doing the same with marijuana in states and municipalities where it's legal. Kim Severson for the New York Times. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're wrapping up this 2014 with a look back at some of the best and worst things that made up the year. And how about the best and worst things that made up you? What you ate or refused to eat in 2014. That's why Dan Pashman is here, host of WNYC's Sporkful Food Podcast and author of Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
I'm great. Now, you've got the best and the worst. Well, why don't we start with the worst and we'll work our way up. What are the three worst things from the year for you?
Well, the first one I would list is ramen everything. This has really gotten out of control. There's been a lot of hubbub, especially around the ramen burrito or ramen taco, where the encasings are made out of solidified ramen, essentially fried or put into a shell in some way. There's also the ramen burger, which is a burger basically on a bun that's been made out of ramen that's been pressed together. I love good ramen, but it's like I ate the ramen burger. It wasn't a great burger, and it wasn't great ramen. Like, it wasn't as good as either of those things.
Well, this next one, I don't want to spoil, but I will spoil it because I am right with you. Boy, am I with you on this one. Pumpkin spice is just, I hope it's over. Is it over?
Well, look, there's way too much money being made on pumpkin spice, especially by Starbucks, for it to be over. But I am optimistic that 2014, in retrospect, will be viewed as the year that it turned the corner. I think that this was the year that people started to really ask themselves serious life questions like, do I really need pumpkin spice cream cheese? Do I really need pumpkin spice coffee creamer?
Or Hershey's Kisses. I mean, come on.
Right, or Hershey's Kisses. Like, do I really need pumpkin spice insert food here? And yeah. Most often you'll find the answer is no, especially because most pumpkin spice has no pumpkin in it. And even if it did, you'd hardly taste it. You're mostly tasting cinnamon, nutmeg, clove, and more than anything, usually sugar or corn syrup. And so it's gross. It's in way too many things. But, you know, just this past year, Starbucks started it in August. They started pumpkin spice latte season earlier. So Starbucks is messing with the seasons here. It's getting really dire, Todd.
Dan Pashman, what would you think about a ramen burrito stuffed inside of a big tub of pumpkin spice cream cheese?
I think that would probably qualify as a Frankenfood, which is number three on my list of worst food trends. ever since the Cronut, which the Cronut is legitimately new and different and creative, since the Cronut came along, it's become especially de rigueur to just mash up two sweet foods. There's the Wonut, which is the waffle and donut, which just not a great idea. There's been all these different foods on Pinterest that involve Oreos. It's like it's an Oreo truffle. It's an Oreo inside a cookie. You know, Todd, you're from Hershey, Pennsylvania. You understand that if you cover things in chocolate and sugar, they may taste good. Doesn't mean that the world needs them.
All right. Well, things have actually been not all bad in the world of eating. They've actually been pretty good. Let's move on to the three best. What are your three best eats of 2014?
Well, the first one I'll say is pickling and fermentation. Kimchi is becoming less and less of sort of a specialty food that you hear about in fancy enclaves, and pickles in general, and pickling all sorts of things. It's a great way to, like, sort of, if you have food in the house that may go bad in the next few days, just throw it in a solution in a jar, and you just saved it for millennia to come, practically.
Yeah, it's fantastic. More and more restaurants, too, you find all kinds of great pickled things on the appetizer dish. It's really great. Now, I'm looking at smoked paprika here. I confess, I didn't know that was a thing.
Smoked paprika is a thing, and it's actually more and more widely available in the spice section of your grocery store. It is, as you would expect, a variation on this more classic sweet Hungarian paprika. It's sometimes called smoked Spanish paprika, although the Hungarian brand sometimes also makes smoked varieties. But it's just a great, easy way to add smoky flavor to almost anything that you're cooking. Just sprinkle some smoked paprika on it. I've seen it in a lot of menus. It's on the maple bacon sticks that they serve at a place called Smorgasburg in Brooklyn, but I've seen it all around the country. I was in California and saw a cocktail that had smoked paprika in it, which is when I really knew that this was something that was on the rise.
All right, and your number one best eat of 2014. I can't wait.
Number one best eat of 2014 or best food trend has got to be lard.
Oh, lard.
Lard is back and better than ever.
And it's been a couple of years because it was a few years ago on the Takeaway we talked about lard, but it hadn't been really on top like it is now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been percolating. Like, none of these things happen overnight. Lard was essentially killed off by a collective effort by Procter & Gamble and Upton Sinclair back in the early part of the 20th century.
And the American Heart Association.
Well, yes, to some extent. But they were late to the game, really. What happened is that there was all this leftover oil when electricity was invented. People didn't run oil lamps anymore. Hydrogenation was invented. You ended up with Crisco, vegetable shortening. And Procter & Gamble wanted to sell that, and they wanted to sell that in place of lard. So they began a campaign to vilify lard as something that was dirty and unclean and unsafe.
But you think lard is great. Like, from a eating experience, you think it's worth doing.
Oh, it's fantastic. And we know now that fat isn't as bad as we thought it was. And there are great high-quality lards that are available. And now we know that partially hydrogenated oils are full of trans fats. And so lard is not only delicious, it is fantastic in pie crusts. There's a flakiness that you get in a pie crust made with lard you can't get any other way. Refried beans. Any self-respecting Mexican-American making refried beans is using lard, I can tell you.
Dan Pashman says go for lard. All right, that's 2014. Let's look ahead. Look, it wouldn't be an end-of-the-year segment without a New Year's resolution. I have to tell you, I did make a New Year's resolution last year, Dan Pashman, to eat more corned beef. I didn't really follow through, and I think I'm renewing that one. I just felt like I wasn't getting enough, and it's something I love. So that was mine. You got a New Year's resolution for 2015?
Well, I'm curious real quick, Todd. What do you think got in the way? Let's diagnose the problem so it doesn't happen to you again.
I think what got in the way was perseverance and stick-to-itiveness, and also it's just really heavy at lunchtime. Sometimes I have designs on a corned beef sandwich, and I don't follow through because I feel weighed down afterward.
That's fair. Why don't you try corned beef sandwiches for dinner?
My God, you're a genius. No wonder we call you Dan Pashman.
Problem solved. My New Year's eating resolution, I do pick one every year, and I love to announce it on the Sporkful podcast. This year it is, drum roll please, MSG. That's right. That whole headache thing turns out to have been debunked. MSG occurs naturally in many foods, and it is umami. It is the essence of umami. And
you're saying you want to eat more MSG?
I want to eat more MSG.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not. I got a sauce called Maggie, M-A-G-G-I, that has MSG in it. I bought a box of MSG at an Asian market. I've been putting this Maggie on almost everything that I eat, and I have never felt better.
Unbelievable. It's sodium, though. It can't be good.
Well, look, too much sodium is not good for you, but there is a depth of flavor that MSG possesses, an umami flavor that you just don't get with regular run-of-the-mill salt. And that's why in lieu of salt or in lieu of soy sauce, I will use this Maggi seasoning or I will throw in some MSG, and I think it's fantastic.
Well, you heard it here first. Dan Pashman of the Sporkful podcast is going to war with the American Heart Association. He's endorsing lard, and he's endorsing more sodium in your diet. So those of you at the Heart Association, Dan Pashman, is your guy. You ready to go to war, Dan?
Well, Todd, as I say on The Sporkful, all things in moderation, including moderation.
That's Dan Pashman, host of WNYC's Sporkful podcast. Dan knows how to eat more better. Happy 2015, Dan.
You too, Todd.
Well, Dan has his resolutions. What about yours, food or otherwise, for 2015? We want to hear them, of course, at 8778MyTake. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.